Presented on WBAI Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. on May 4th, when we bring you a forum presented by the Alzheimer's Foundation of America for New York vets and your families. Did you know that based on military experience, vets may be at a higher risk for dementia? The risk also increases with age. That's Tuesday, May 4th from 11 to 12 p.m. You'll receive info on brain health memory screenings and veteran benefits. May 4th at 11 a.m., presented on WBAI in cooperation with the Alzheimer's Foundation of America.
It's 10 o'clock in New York City, and you're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next, Green Street.
What can you really believe? How do you know something is true or not? There's always been spin, of course, but now it seems that almost everything we hear or read is spin. Facts have become a source of controversy. We think of spin mostly in political terms, but what if it threatened your life? When companies intentionally mislead the public about the safety of their products, it's not just spin. It's a crime. This is how companies protect themselves, their dangerous products, and their profits. And this is Green Street.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Green Street. Patty and Doug Wood and our network of scientists, medical professionals, public health experts, authors, activists, and others, all here on Tuesday mornings to help you make sense of what you hear and learn how you and your family can live a better, safer, and healthier life in this increasingly toxic world. Today on Green Street, we'll talk with one of the nation's leading experts on endocrine disruption. But we're not actually going to talk about that. Instead, we're going to talk about the specific things that big corporations and the government agencies that are supposed to monitor those corporations do when they're faced with scientific data that show that their products or activities are harmful or dangerous in some way. What are the most effective methods they use to confuse or mislead the public to protect themselves? It's a fascinating and somewhat disturbing new field of scientific research, and one you should really know about so you can discern for yourself when you're being lied to by people with profits and products to protect. That's all coming up on this edition of Green Street. But first, here's Patty with the Green Street News. What do you got for us today?
Okay, so my first article is from the New York Times. And the title is, This is Your Brain on Processed Food. And the writer is Anahad O'Connor. A fascinating new book by Michael Moss, an investigative journalist and best-selling author, argues that the tobacco industry's definition of addiction could apply to our relationship with another group of products that Philip Morris sold and manufactured for decades, highly processed foods. In his new book, Hooked, Mr. Moss explores the science behind addiction and builds a case that food companies have painstakingly engineered processed foods to hijack the reward circuitry in our brains, causing us to overeat and helping to fuel a global epidemic of obesity and chronic disease. Mr. Moss suggests not only that processed foods like cheeseburgers, potato chips, and ice cream are more addictive, but that they can be even more addictive than alcohol, tobacco, and drugs. The book draws on internal industry documents and interviews with industry insiders to argue that some food companies in the past couple of decades became aware of the addictive nature of their products and took drastic steps to avoid accountability, such as shutting down important research into sugary foods and spearheading laws preventing people from suing food companies for damages. In another cynical move, Mr. Moss writes, food companies beginning in the late 1970s started buying a slew of popular diet companies, allowing them to profit off our attempts to lose the weight we gained from eating their products. Heinz, the processed food giant, bought Weight Watchers in 1978 for $72 million. Unilever, which sells Klondike bars and Ben & Jerry's ice cream, paid $2.3 billion for SlimFast in 2000. And Nestle, which makes chocolate bars and Hot Pockets, purchased Jenny Craig in 2006 for $600 million. The food industry blocked us in the courts from filing lawsuits claiming addiction. They started controlling the science in problematic ways, and they took control of the diet industry. Mr. Moss says, I've been crawling through the underbelly of the processed food industry for 10 years, and I continue to be stunned by the depths of the deviousness of their strategy to not just tap into our basic instincts, but to exploit our attempts to gain control of our habits. One crucial element that influences the addictive nature of a substance and whether or not we consume it compulsively is how quickly it excites the brain. The faster it hits our reward circuitry, the stronger its impact. No addictive drug can fire up the reward circuitry in our brains as rapidly as our favorite foods, Mr. Moss writes. Smoke from cigarettes takes 10 seconds to stir the brain, but a touch of sugar on the tongue will do so in a little more than a half a second, or 600 milliseconds to be precise, he writes. That's nearly 20 times faster than cigarettes. Mr. Moss explains that even people in the tobacco industry took note of the powerful lure of processed foods. In the 1980s, Philip Morris acquired Kraft and General Foods, making it the largest manufacturer of processed foods in the country, with products like Kool-Aid, Cocoa Pebbles, Capri Sun, and Oreo cookies. But the company's former general counsel and vice president, Stephen Parrish, confided that he found it troubling that it was easier for him to quit the company's cigarettes than its chocolate cookies. As litigation against tobacco companies gained ground in the 1990s, one of the industry's defenses was that cigarettes were no more addictive than Twinkies. It may have been onto something. Wow.
It's really quite astonishing, isn't it, that the companies that made cigarettes bought all these fast food companies, and then they bought the diet companies.
Yeah, because they realized that they were more addictive. The products that these fast food companies were making were more addictive than tobacco.
Wow.
It's criminal.
It's criminal.
I don't know what else. Yeah. I don't know what other word to use for this. I mean,
that's suffering. That's a good word.
You know, they're suffering from obesity and diabetes and heart disease and high blood pressure and all these other things that are related to gaining weight and to, you know, this kind of addiction. It's really, really unconscionable.
Okay. Well, that was a good article. What else you got?
Okay. So another one that's also interesting. It's written in The Guardian, and the title is Bill Gates is the biggest private owner of farmland in the United States.
Really?
Why?
Farm. Okay.
Nick Estes wrote this article. Bill Gates has never been a farmer, so why did the Land Report dub him Farmer Bill this year? The third richest man on the planet doesn't have a green thumb. Nor does he put in the backbreaking labor humble people do to grow our food and who get far less praise for it. That kind of hard work isn't what made him rich. In total, Gates owns approximately 242,000 acres of farmland, with assets totaling more than $690 million. To put that into perspective, that's nearly the size of Hong Kong. Land is power, land is wealth, and more importantly, land is about race and class. The relationship to land, who owns it, who works it, and who cares for it, reflects obscene levels of inequality and legacies of colonialism and white supremacy in the United States and also the world. Wealth accumulation always goes hand in hand with exploitation and dispossession. In this country, enslaved black labor first built U.S. wealth atop stolen native land. The 1862 Homestead Act opened up 270 million acres of indigenous territory, which amounts to 10% of U.S. land, for white settlement. Black, Mexican, Asian, and Native people, of course, were categorically excluded from the benefits of a federal program that subsidized and protected generations of white wealth. The billionaire media mogul Ted Turner epitomizes such disparities. He owns 2 million acres and has the world's largest privately owned buffalo herd. Those animals, which are sacred to indigenous peoples and were nearly hunted to extinction by settlers, are preserved today on nearly 200,000 acres of Turner's ranchland in the western half of what is now the state of South Dakota, land that was once guaranteed by the U.S. government to be a quote-unquote permanent home for Lakota people. But billionaire class assertions that they are philosopher kings and climate conscious investors who know better than the original caretakers are little more than ruses for what amounts to a 21st century land grab with big payouts in a for-profit economy seeking green solutions. Our era is dominated by the ultra-rich, the climate crisis, and a burgeoning green capitalism. And Bill Gates' new book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster, positions himself as a thought leader in how to stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and how to fund what he has called elsewhere a global green revolution, which is to help poor farmers mitigate climate change. What expertise in climate science or agriculture Gates possesses beyond being filthy rich is anyone's guess. The world's richest 1% emit double the carbon of the poorest 50%, a 2020 Oxfam study found. The principal danger of private farmland owners like Bill Gates is not their professed support of sustainable agriculture, often found in philanthropic work. It's the monopolistic role they play in determining our food systems and land use patterns. Small farmers and indigenous people are more cautious with the use of land. For indigenous caretakers, land use isn't premised on a return of investments. It's about maintaining the land for the next generation, meeting the needs of the present, and a respect for the diversity of life. The land we all live on should not be the sole property of a few. The extensive tax avoidance by these titans of industry will always far exceed their supposed charitable donations to the public. The quote-unquote billionaire knows best mentality detracts from the deep-seated realities of colonialism and white supremacy, and it ignores those who actually know best how to use and live with the land.
This is what I love. The world's richest 1% emit double the carbon of the poorest 50% of the world.
Yeah, holy cow.
Yeah. You know, that point about the tax write-offs is absolutely true. They put out these press releases about how wonderful they are. They're doing all these wonderful things, and they're, you know, going to do this and do that. Meanwhile, they're taking a tax write-off that keeps money.
Right, and they're buying up all these other companies that are going to enrich them, that are associated
just like the article
with their,
you
with
read
their
before.
Land purchases.
It's really
it's
no
just
different.
Like the article that I read before?
It's all
is
the same.
Is that true?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
That's so interesting.
All right, what else you got?
Okay, so I got another great article that actually has to be heard. It was published in Forbes. The title is An Electromagnetic Health Crisis, and it was written by Jayshree Pandya. Exposure to the electromagnetic field is not a new phenomenon for living beings. While living beings have always been exposed to natural electromagnetic fields, the growing sources, applications, and impact of human-made electric and magnetic fields, EMFs, on humans and the environment are creating more questions than answers. This is extraordinarily complex to evaluate when all living beings are technically electromagnetic, and every thought and emotion is a measurable frequency as well. To date, the most critical criterion used to understand whether any particular radio frequency radiation is dangerous has been the category of ionizing or non-ionizing radiation. But is this still useful and valid today as we begin to evaluate that extremely low frequency of electromagnetic radiation on living beings? It seems that all types of human-made EMFs and electromagnetic radiation, or EMR, in contrast to natural EMFs and EMR, are polarized. Polarized EMFs and EMR can have increased biological activity. Consequently, these features render human-made EMFs and EMR more bioactive than natural non-ionizing EMFs and EMR. As a result, there is a growing concern that the biologically active human-made electric and magnetic fields may be at the root of some mounting health concerns for humans. Over the years, there have been many studies to understand the role of extremely low-frequency EMF exposures from conventional power sources and home appliances. According to the National Institutes of Environmental Health Sciences report, while some of these studies showed a possible link between EMF field strength and an increased risk for childhood leukemia, their findings indicated that such an association was weak. But now, in a rapidly transforming digital age, with wireless routers, Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, 5G, the Internet of Things, radio and TV signals, mobile phones, and more, the applications and sources of EMF are proliferating. As a result, fears are amplifying about possible connections between EMF and adverse health effects on humans, other living beings, and the environment. Based on the thousands of published reports, there are growing concerns about radio frequency radiation that can, one, damage the DNA of any biological species and lead to cancer, two, cause oxidative damage that can cause premature aging, three, disrupt cell metabolism, and four, potentially lead to other diseases through the generation of stress proteins. As we evaluate why human-made EMFs are more bioactive than naturally occurring electromagnetic fields, there are perhaps more questions than answers. Since biological effects are measurable responses to an electromagnetic stimulus or a change in the environment, should we not put efforts toward having a sufficient understanding of the impact of human-made electromagnetic fields on biology on a cellular level?
You know, this is the kind of op-ed that should have come out in every paper after the NTP study, which kind of proved that non-ionizing radiation, which has always been thought of as relatively harmless, is capable of doing. So that never happened. And articles like that just didn't appear. We're going to be talking more about
why. I know, we're going to be talking about that with our guest today, yeah, which is why I ended with that article so that we could make a good transition there, because she's going to be talking about, you know, industry spin.
Yeah.
And,
exactly,
you know, what the talking points are and how they suppress these kinds of questions that the public should actually be hearing experts ask, and they should be asking those questions themselves as well and making better choices.
All right. Thanks, Patty. We'll be right back. Humans are curious. We like to figure things out. Why is the world the way it is? What causes things to happen? And how can we use that information to make our lives better? Day after day, week after week, and month after month, research scientists in laboratories across the country and around the world piece together tiny bits of information in an effort to advance our understanding of the world. And sometimes, but not always, they discover another clue. And because science is a collaborative effort, they share their discovery with the world by publishing the results of their work. And that's where the trouble starts. Because sometimes what scientists discover is that something we originally thought was good turns out to be not as good as we thought. And often it means that something some company is making or doing is actually harmful to our safety or our health in ways we didn't understand before. And what happens next is critical. How does the public learn about this discovery? Who informs them and how? Who spins the story to their advantage and how do they do it? Dr. Laura Vandenberg is Associate Dean of Undergraduate Academic Affairs and Associate Professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and one of the world's leading authorities on endocrine-disrupting chemicals and hazard assessment. Her recent study is called The Science of Spin: Targeted Strategies to Manufacture Doubt with Detrimental Effects on Environmental and Public Health. Patty and I spoke with Dr. Vandenberg last week. We asked her what led her to publish this new study.
I'm actually a research scientist, and I've been working for about 15 years to study the effects of endocrine-disrupting chemicals. So those are chemicals that interfere with the way that hormones act in the body. And I've been studying the effects of those endocrine disruptors on outcomes that are relevant to women's health. So a lot of my research focuses on breast development, breast function, like your ability to make milk, and breast disease, including cancer. We use the rodent as the model in our lab. And so a lot of my work is actually done in the lab, but I also spend about half of my research time really trying to understand how different groups and agencies and organizations use data to make decisions that are meant to be protective for public health. So, like, why does the EPA do and say what it does about endocrine disruptors? And why does that differ from what academics and advocates often feel is the case for data around endocrine disruptors? So where's that disconnect coming, and how can we fix it.
Mm. That's big. Yeah. That's a big job.
I mean, yeah. Right. I mean, in the lab, I can go in and I can sort of dissect the fine points of biology. Like, how do our bodies actually work? Which, as a trained biologist, that's what I'm fascinated by. Mm-hmm. Like, think about one of the most amazing sort of miracles of science is that we all start as a single cell. And yet our bodies, for the most part, end up where everything is in the right place. And it's all there at the right time. Like, we think of it sort of as a miracle, because it kind of is. Mm-hmm. But to study the biology of how that happens is, it's an amazing privilege to be able to look at that kind of level in the lab. And I love that part. But the part, the science that I do that's outside of the lab to try to understand information, decision-making, risk, and hazards, that's the stuff that actually sort of moves the needle the most in the life of a regular person. So how do we protect people from hazards in their environment that they don't even realize are there?
Hmm. Yeah, that's the big question. And I guess that you're up against the industries when you're trying to do this.
Well, before we go there, let me go back and ask you, is it different now than it was in the past? Or has it always been that it's difficult to get the truth about I don't want to use the word truth, the facts about science out to the public?
Well, I mean, it's a complicated life story of how science has and will be done. In the world of public health, of things that affect the public's health, I think a lot of the best lessons we can learn is actually from tobacco and cigarettes, where today no one reasonably disputes that smoking cigarettes causes lung cancer and a whole host of other chronic health problems for smokers. Mm-hmm. But there's still this big machinery out there of disinformation. And really, in my lifetime, in my adult lifetime, we've continued to see some of that machinery at work. So, you know, in 2001, I think it was, Mike Pence, who ultimately became the Vice President of the United States, wrote a blog basically saying smoking doesn't kill because not every smoker dies.
Oh.
Right? Like, and that's such a strange argument to make, and yet it's an effective one at tweaking the public's view of the data, of the evidence that actually links smoking to serious public health harm. Right? Yeah. And not everyone who smokes will die from smoking. But does that mean that we should not worry about smoking? That's not an argument that, from a public health perspective, holds much water.
Of course. But it has that little bit of ring of truth to it.
Absolutely true. Right. It's absolutely true. And that's how it manipulates people into thinking. And, you know, I think a lot of us have this example of, well, my great Grammy lived to be 104 and she ate bacon every day and she smoked a cigar on Sundays. Right. We know those stories. And we extrapolate that kind of information out in a way that we don't do the same thing for, but I also know, you know, my friend's uncle who lost his limb to diabetes because mm-hmm. of poor care, right? Mm-hmm. We extrapolate the joyful stories of people who overcame bad habits and weren't harmed by them, but then we sort of ignore the ones that are right in front of us, of which there are so many, of people who have been harmed by smoking,
right,
or have been harmed by poor sugar control, or have been harmed by, you know, you name it, what's in their environment.
So interesting. So, and why is it that the public will take the word of a politician like Mike Pence?
Yeah.
Over the word of, you know, scientists, of course, you know, he has a bigger platform, right?
Yeah. He's got
a big megaphone he can get out there. But why do people actually listen to someone who's completely unqualified to make a statement about something like cigarette smoking and not listen to the real scientists and the real
right.
truth?
Right. So I think part of this is a relatively modern idea of everyone can do research, And I actually believe that it is the lovely part of creating a democratic access to scientific information. This push to have more scientists publish their work in an open access format, so everyone can go and actually read the scientific studies. But most people don't choose to go read scientific studies.
Right.
They still use, you know, the analysis that's published by the mainstream media,
mm-hmm.
or the analysis that's published on a blog.
Correct.
And so they don't go look at the actual data. They don't even feel comfortable going and looking at the actual data. So they'll take someone else's word for it for what that data say. And so, right, back to this Mike Pence example, he's correct in saying, you know, that only 1 out of 9 smokers will actually die from lung cancer, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that means 8 out of 9 are totally fine. The data are correct, but that's a tiny snapshot of all of the data that we have about the other health effects
sure.
of smoking, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it also doesn't look at 1 out of 9. Compare that to if no one was smoking, how many would actually die from lung cancer? Because it's not zero, but it's not 1 out of 9.
Exactly.
And so it's the way of sort of preying upon people's lack of information on a topic, and also a lack of sort of the bigger picture of how science is done, about how information is collected. It also, the discussion of science becomes a discussion of celebrity. And this is actually a tactic that we've seen that industry has used. Is it was discussed in documents that were released from the BPA industry, an industry that a chemical that I've studied, so an industry that I've followed, where in their documents they talked about trying to get famous people to talk about the benefits of BPA in their lives.
Right, exactly.
Right? So if we can get a celebrity, you know, a movie star, to talk about how great it is to have a polycarbonate baby bottle, that's good enough to convince people that it's safe.
Sure. The social media influencers.
Yeah, yeah.
Perfect.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. That
right.
we've sort of twisted this whose opinion really matters.
Right.
And I think that that's a very slippery slope.
Yeah. Exactly. So I would really like to get to the actual research that you did with your colleague Rebecca Goldberg, and the title of this research paper is The Science of Spin, Targeted Strategies to Manufacture Doubt with Detrimental Effects on Environmental and Public Health. And we were just talking about one of the tactics that were used, but you have actually identified in this research that you've done 5 tactics that were used by all 5 of the industries or organizations that you looked at. So what are these 5 tactics?
Right. Can I back up just
sure,
for a second
absolutely.
To sort of explain what we did?
Yeah.
So for now many years, I've been teaching an environmental health course or a series of courses at University of Massachusetts Amherst that focuses on understanding various case studies. Very, very well-documented, well-described case studies where industries or organizations have taken scientific information and warped it. And so the tobacco industry is, again, the most famous one of those, where they wrote a playbook of what they could do as a way to confuse the public or use doubt as a way to misinform the public. And they got very good at it. And so I used to teach these as examples. And Rebecca was a student who came to me and she said, I want to write something about this. She was just so fascinated by it. And I thought, well, that's a clever idea
mm-hmm.
as a way to sort of present to a readership the fact that there's these examples that come from very different industries or organizations, but they're using the same tactics over and over again. That really fascinated me. And so the first thing that Rebecca did was to go try to find the sort of formative texts from these different industries. The 5 industries that we picked, we started with tobacco since it's the most commonly discussed across public health.
Mm-hmm.
We also looked at the coal industry and what it had done to manufacture doubt about the harm of exposure to coal and coal dust on black lung disease in
mm-hmm.
its own employees.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at sugar industries because there are several really excellent books that have described the kind of scientific studies that were done by organizations that were paid by sugar industry and then by others that demonstrated that exposure to sugar, refined sugar, would increase risk for cardiovascular disease. And the sugar industry utilized that information to instead cast blame or doubt on high-fat diet and to hide the impact of sugar on human health. The fourth industry was the agrochemical producer of the chemical
pesticide atrazine, right?
Yeah, which got a lot of attention a few years ago. So this is a pesticide that's used to control weeds, and it's an endocrine disruptor. And really, this is an example of an industry that, or a company, that went after a single person. And that's the story of Dr. Tyrone Hayes, mm-hmm. where his evidence and his data were really showing that atrazine caused harm specifically to amphibians, and they targeted him personally. And then the last is the example of the Marshall Institute, which was a post-Cold War institute that had to pivot from work focused on the Cold War, which after the Cold War ended, the institute didn't want to disband. They really, the people who were associated with that institute enjoyed having a closeness to the federal government. And so they pivoted and became an institute that was focused on climate change, but really on dispelling any research or any knowledge about climate change, any acknowledgement of climate change at the level of the federal government. And they took a lot of money from
the fossil fuel industry,
oil and gas,
yeah,
more multinational companies. So these are very different examples. And so it's almost insane to think that you could look across these five different industries or groups and learn something from them. And yet what we found is that across these five organizations or groups, there were 28 unique tactics that were used by these organizations to either try to combat known scientific facts or knowledge or evidence. So they were working to counter scientific knowledge that was damaging to their profits or to their place. And then there were other tactics that were used to promote narratives that were favorable to the industry. And so 28 unique tactics were identified across these five industries, but five of those 28 were used by all five of the organizations. So I don't know if you want to dig into those a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I mean, if you could just mention, you know, the five strategies that they all used that seemed to be, you know, the most
successful, shall we say?
Successful, yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah, I mean, clearly these are strategies because they work across these five very different kinds of organizations. It sort of implies that they're very productive. Mm-hmm. They're very seductive, right? They allow an industry to promote their agenda. So the first one is to attack the study design of any study that was used to produce information that suggests harm from their industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, right, in this example, it would be the very first studies that showed that tobacco was associated with increased risk for cancer. Well, an association doesn't mean that it's causing that. So, you know, that's an easy way to sort of start to attack the study and to attack the way that the data were collected. And I say this with all of the acknowledgement that a scientist should have, that no study is perfect. You can always attack a study.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But these are attacks that are done really for the purpose of poking holes in evidence.
Mm-hmm.
The second tactic is to recruit individuals who are considered reputable individuals to defend information that is supportive of the industry. So the Mike Pence example that I gave earlier, where Mike Pence writes writes an editorial that's in defense of the tobacco industry, that's a great example of a person who's considered a reputable individual, even though he has no scientific credentials, right? He's a person who is well known to that community.
That, you know, well, let me just stop you for a second. I mean, it is so widely accepted, I would think, in the public mind that smoking is harmful. Does it really help? I mean, for an industry that's that far back on its heels to wheel out somebody to say, oh, no, I think it's fine. Did you find that that strategy really worked? Yeah, especially in cases like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but especially in cases like tobacco, where it's, I think the game is over on tobacco. Or am I wrong about that?
I mean, wait a second. And I want to add to that. I mean, you know, if you have to fill out a form, if you go to a doctor's office, right, you fill out a form and it says, do you smoke?
Sure.
And how much do you smoke?
Yeah, but you know people lie, right?
So, but they ask the question.
Yeah.
So it gives it legitimacy, right? And everybody has done this. Everybody has filled out those forms and seen that it asks you whether you're a smoker, because that's a risk factor.
Absolutely. I mean, the cost of getting life insurance is different for smokers
sure.
versus non-smokers.
That's right.
But they also know that people lie. So people will tell you that they're not smokers. So they'll collect your urine, and then they can measure the metabolite from
the
cigarette smoke in
right.
your urine.
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
and
yeah.
in fact, right, there's human biomonitoring studies that suggest that somewhere around 30% of smokers lie to their physicians about whether or not they're smokers. So people know that it's bad for them, and yet they still aren't even honest about it.
Mm.
I think that a lot of the gaining support from reputable individuals is something that you do at earlier phases of this manufacturing doubt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the tobacco industry doing that in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even 80s, where they would say, here's an example of a judge, and look, he smokes Camel.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
X out of Y doctors prefer R.J. Reynolds cigarettes,
yep. right?
So they would use that the whole purpose of that is to suggest that people who know more than you, Joe Q,
mm-hmm.
Think that this is a good thing to do, or think that this is a safe thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it does work. I think even in the year 2001, I'm trying to think about like where in my life course was I? So like, what did I know about tobacco smoking in 2001? So I was in college in 2001. Did I think that smoking was dangerous? Yep. That had been a message that I had received really throughout my entire childhood. But if I, in 2001, had read an editorial that said, you do realize only 1 out of 9 smokers will die from lung cancer, I would have thought, wow, really? That's it?
Yeah, not so bad.
It's not as bad as you would think. What you're not comparing that to, you know, only 1 out of 900 non-smokers will die, right? Like, you don't mm-hmm. know what the comparison
mm-hmm.
is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think numbers fool us in a way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's why it remains an effective tool to have someone that people respect say, wait a second here, let me poke some holes in it. Because
right.
you're not going to change people's minds about whether or not it's dangerous. You're going to change their minds about how dangerous is it? How risky is it? Do I really need to quit? I'm already smoking.
Mm-hmm.
Do I really need mm-hmm. to quit? Or is it okay if I keep smoking for another couple of years? I'll quit when I'm 40, right? Oh, I'll quit when I'm 45.
Yeah, and of course,
that's part of it.
It's so hard to quit smoking that any little bit of evidence that maybe you don't have to do it, I suspect, would be so difficult for smokers who are addicted to
absolutely
to
absolutely
yeah, they're going to glom onto that
sure.
and that's all
yeah.
they're going to that's all they want to know.
We as humans are so bad at evaluating risk. Right, I
yeah.
ask my students all the time, okay, how many of you are afraid of sharks in the ocean? Right, and you get like 10% of them raise their hands.
Right.
And I'm like, okay, how many of you are afraid of vending machines? But you're much more likely to be killed by a vending machine falling on top of you, right? Like, we're not, which is also a ridiculous thing to be afraid of.
Right.
We're not nearly as afraid of heart disease as we should be.
Mm.
Right, we're just not, because it's so common.
Exactly.
Most of us are not afraid to get in the car and go to the grocery store, and yet we're much more likely to die going to the grocery store than we are, you know, from attack of killer bees.
So yeah.
We just have these misperceptions of risk because our brains are trained to be afraid of things that we don't understand
yeah. right.
and that we don't see a lot of. We see a lot of heart disease, so it's not frightening to us. And that's really unfortunate because You know, it's the leading killer in the United States and globally.
You're listening to Green Street on WBAI, and our guest is Dr. Laura Vandenberg, Associate Dean of Undergraduate Academic Affairs and Associate Professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and author of a new study titled The Science of Spin: Targeted Strategies to Manufacture Doubt with Detrimental Effects on Environmental and Public Health. All right, so we have attack the study. We have recruit individuals who are believable, quote unquote. We have other things, yeah.
The third one is just misrepresenting the evidence that is produced. So, you know, when you discuss studies that suggest that your product is harmful, you can twist and turn those. And if a scientist like me does that, I lose my reputation, I lose my ability to continue publishing, I lose my ability to get future funding for future studies, I lose my career. But if someone does that and they're paid by the chemical organization afterwards, they're like, oh, sorry, I was wrong, and nothing bad happens to them. So there's no downward pressure to be truthful.
To be honest.
And so they can get away with this misrepresentation.
Well, yikes. Okay, next. What's my fourth one?
The next one is to employ hyperbolic language. Some of what we've seen are terms that were created by the industry that now pervade scientific discourse, which is really frustrating. I'm going to give you an example. The term sound science. And Naomi Oreskes, who's a great historian of science, has this quote that says, sound science sounds like science, but it's not. The whole idea of sound science versus junk science, that was created by the tobacco industry. And yet we've seen people that now we see books that are published, often by folks who have been paid by the tobacco industry, that use these terms, junk science, right? It's my job as a crusader to root out junk science. Well, what's junk science to them? It's science that highlights problems with pesticides or with air pollution or with endocrine disruptors. What's sound science? It's the science that's been done by the industry. Sounds like science.
The term junk science conjures up images of people who don't know what they're doing writing up a scientific study, right? I mean, it's junk. It has no value. Whereas sound science sounds...
Right, it's the same thing as doctors who they call quacks, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's a quackery.
That's right. We also see this with, you know, how they will marginalize scientists who speak up about science, who educate the public about science. They'll say, oh, well, they're advocates now. Right? You're not a scientist any longer if you've spoken to the public.
And there's a big deal about crossing that line, isn't there? When you have somebody who's a very, very well-respected, a highly educated and, you know, credible scientist or medical doctor, and they cross that line into advocacy, that is a very dangerous thing for them to do.
Absolutely, but who defines what's advocacy is again the point, right? That's the hyperbolic part. Even speaking to you on a radio show means that I'm doing advocacy. You're basically saying we get to define what the job of a scientist is. And a scientist, according to that hyperbolic language, should never leave the lab.
Right.
Should never talk about the results of their studies, because then the public would be aware of that information. So if I can define advocate in that way, I can then marginalize scientists who are speaking about their science.
Yeah, but we absolutely need scientists who come out and speak about their research.
About what they know.
About what they know. Sure. Obviously, you know, this is critical to protecting public health, which is what we're all trying to do.
I could not agree more. I mean, what you're saying, obviously, I believe that because here I am chatting with you.
Yes.
But I think that it's actually a very effective tool at influencing environmental health and environmental health scientists, because they're ultimately, we're taught in school, do your science, stick to the science, let other people do the translation for the public. But then we get back to the idea of, okay, who's going to do that translating? If industry's doing the translating, they misrepresent the data or they trash the study as a way to dismiss the results that you find.
Sure.
So it's, again, an extremely effective tactic, because you get to marginalize the person, and then you get to marginalize the results, and then you get to marginalize any future study that comes from that sort of field of work.
That's so interesting, Laura, because when Patty won the 2016 Children's Environmental Health Excellence Award from the EPA, we went down to Washington, and they treated her like a rock star because they said, the people at the EPA said, Patty, we're so delighted that you can do what we can't do, which is to educate the public about the dangers of
about
environmental health. And I was so struck by that because I thought, but that's your job. That's what you,
that's
what you, EPA, are supposed to be doing. But they felt so constrained by this chill of stepping on the wrong side of the line between advocacy and science that they were hamstrung. And it just astonished and disappointed. And
so I would love to just go to the, you know, if we can. We've got our five tactics here.
No, we have three far.
No, we have four.
We have four.
Oh. We have four.
I didn't reach the fifth one.
Okay, go.
Yeah, so first is a tech study design. Second is get support from reputable individuals to defend your own industry. Third is misrepresent information that's counter to your industry's argument. Fourth is this hyperbolic language.
Oh, okay.
Fifth is actually influence government agencies or laws. So we've seen this with the fossil fuel industry influencing laws around and regulations. Is CO2 a pollutant or not? That's an actual argument. Is CO2 a pollutant? Well, it becomes a semantics argument rather than a health-oriented argument, an environmental health or a public health-oriented argument. We saw this with the producers of atrazine. They were very closely interacting with scientists at the EPA. And I've seen this in my own research with some of the documents that were released through Freedom Information Act requests from reporters to the FDA that about BPA, that this is an example where the industry has a very close relationship with regulators, that what you could see is a new study would come out and the regulators would write to the American Chemistry Council, how should we talk about this study? They weren't calling me up to say, how should we talk about this study? What does this study mean?
Well,
they were calling the industry up.
Yeah.
That's frustrating, that close relationship, but it's very effective.
That, okay, so we've got these things. Laura, in your study, you identify a few things that you think could be done, and I found it very, very interesting. And I want to ask you if there were some low... Obviously, this is a gigantic problem, right? And it's been building for a long time.
Sure, so you just throw us the low-hanging fruit and we'll take care of it.
Well, I just want to know, what are the things that you think, gee, you know, this wouldn't be so hard to do, to institute this change that might help alleviate some of this problem?
Yeah, so, you know, we make recommendations for what the lay public can do, for what scientists can do. What I would say for what the lay public can do is that we have to sort of reframe in people's minds what we mean by when we just sort of offhand say to someone, well, you should do some research on this. Like, what does that mean to do research on something?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, it is not my intention to disparage the mainstream media or the way that the media talks about scientific studies. But oftentimes what we see reported in the news comes from a press release that's written as a way of summarizing what's in a scientific study. And the reporter often doesn't have the time or the training to be able to go and actually look at the scientific study itself. But a lot of these studies are publicly available. And when we're reading summaries of scientific studies, we have to be aware of, like, where did that summary come from?
Mm-hmm.
Even just looking at, like, who has a vested interest in this issue and what, and educating ourselves about conflicts of interest. And that doesn't mean that no good knowledge could ever possibly come from scientists that are funded by the tobacco industry. But we have to sort of look at research with that lens of, does this person have a vested interest in what the results are? Now, industry has already flipped that argument kind of on its head to say, well, academic scientists have a vested interest because you have to apply for grants. And if you don't find that chemical X is dangerous, you won't be able to get a grant.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And my reply to that is, number one, I'm a biologist. So I would love to stop studying chemicals if we stop polluting ourselves with them and go back to studying hormones, because there's so much interesting stuff in just the way our bodies work that I don't need to find a dangerous chemical in order to be able to understand how the body works. But number two, we don't pick the chemicals hoping to find something hazardous about them. In fact, we would love to study a chemical and find that it's not so hazardous. But then we'll move on to the next chemical and on to the next chemical and on to the next chemical.
Yeah.
So there is no vested interest in finding that chemical X is hazardous, because if it's not, I'm going to move on to Y and then Z and then A, B, and C. So that argument doesn't really hold weight, but it's often used, and we just have to be aware that it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
We also have to sort of demand more from the people and the organizations we do get information from. There's this great saying that journalists shouldn't ask two people what the weather is and just present it as if one says that it's raining and one says that it's sunny. Okay, well, those are equal arguments. The journalist's job is to open up the window, stick their hand out, and see if it gets wet. Right.
Yeah.
So oftentimes what we see are arguments that are in these really important public health topics that are presented as if the two sides have equal weight. There isn't equal weight to the climate science and climate denialist argument. It's not equal weight. So we should demand better from the news organizations that we frequent, that I'm not going to read stuff if you're just presenting it and I have to figure out what the objective truth is.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists who actually often have the credential of experts also have to be aware of how conflicts of interest influence our own science and also the kind of science that we cite. And I don't think my colleagues are even doing that work to look at who funded the study. So I'm training my students to go look at who funded the study and do they have vested interests of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it doesn't mean we don't believe work that comes from organizations that have a financial interest, but we should read them with that lens
mm-hmm.
in mind.
Sure.
And we have to demand better from groups that don't disclose their conflicts of interest. And this was a big deal in the clinical side, the pharmaceutical side,
sure.
the medical devices,
right.
that physicians were not reporting that they had gotten funding from the industry that had produced something that they were studying or the drug that they were evaluating.
Right.
And they tried to clean that up in the clinical side. We need to continue to clean that up on
mm-hmm.
the environmental health side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the political side, because ultimately a lot of this comes down to wanting better regulation and policy, which doesn't mean necessarily more regulation and policy, since I think that again, is one of those red flags for people, but better regulation and policy. And we recognize that, you know, people who are elected to office are not scientists, usually. So what we need to do is to find avenues to present truly impartial people to provide information as resources, and then hopefully we can address this revolving door that we've seen between industries and the agencies that are meant to oversee those industries. Because if we don't address that point, we're not going to address the unspoken conflicts of interest. Like
mm-hmm.
if I regulate you in a way that makes you happy, when I lead this regulatory agency, I have a good job waiting for with you.
So, Laura, I'm assuming that you're not the only one who feels this way. Is there any movement among research scientists to organize some sort of good housekeeping seal of approval so that a study can be endorsed by a group of people who have pledged to a set of principles that that would keep the, you know, that would set some sort of standards?
I don't know that there's anything like that afoot. What I do know, so first of all, I should acknowledge that, like, we're not the first this world to study this concept of manufactured doubt. And to your listeners, I can recommend some really excellent books, including one published just this past year by David Michaels, which really digs into examples of how industries, wide-ranging industries like the NFL, the alcohol industry, you know, the tobacco, have been able to exploit these ways of manufacturing doubt. Yeah. It's a great book, a great read. I don't think that there's a plan for anything like a seal of approval. I think what we're, as a scientific community, what we need to address are journals that don't require disclosures of conflicts and actually requiring that they retract studies when you find out that the conflicts of interest were misrepresented in some way. And we've seen that with some of the pesticides that are undergoing litigation right now, that during discovery for documents in lawsuits, it's turned out that that sometimes the pesticide industry wrote papers and then other people's names are on those papers. So a practice that we think of as ghostwriting, which is not allowed in science, but also the role of that industry organization is not disclosed in the manuscript anywhere. If those kinds of papers can't be retracted, those are journals that we should not be publishing in, we should not be citing. That is not science, right? That's PR that looks like science.
You've been listening to Green Street on WBAI, and our guest this morning has been Dr. Laura Vandenberg, Associate Dean of Undergraduate Academic Affairs and Associate Professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's the author of a new study titled The Science of Spin, Targeted Strategies to Manufacture Doubt with Detrimental Effects on Environmental and Public Health. If you missed any part of today's show, you can hear it all over again at our website, greenstreetradio.com. And there you can also sign up for our show alerts and send us your comments on the show. Again, it's www.greenstreetradio.com. That's going to do it for this edition of Green Street. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. Laura Vandenberg, to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, and to the other folks at WBAI who work so hard to keep this unique and remarkable radio station on the air. And, of course, you, our listeners, without whom there would be dead silence at 99.5 FM in New York. We are so grateful for your faithful financial support of this station. If you haven't contributed recently, please consider doing so today. Patty and I will be back in 2 weeks with another edition of Green Street. Until then, please stay safe, keep your mask on, take care.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
I took a pounding from the radio today. I heard the radio say it over and over, and there was no escape.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
Extinction Diaries. 12 scientific studies conducted by 56 authors have concluded that we are on the very edge of collapsing most terrestrial insect populations to the point of no return. Habitat loss is high on the list of human activity forcing declines. Researchers point to the tropics as worrisome, where burning and logging are at a warlike pace. Scientists believe most species there have not even been discovered yet and will be extinct before they are. The second largest loss of insect habitat is grasslands, replaced by industrial farming and livestock production. And along with conversion comes insect-deadly pesticides, many known to cause cancer and other diseases in humans. However, the studies are pointing to climate change as the insect enemy number one. For the past 50 years, climate change has been accelerating and insects have lost 50 to 70% of their populations and facing a further 10 to 20% loss per decade. If we remember them as relatives, we may find the solutions. My name is Odin Lee Daly. This is a Small World Radio production.
Extinction Rebellion Radio is on WBAI every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., hosted by Matthew Kearney and A.B. Slank.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
This week on Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI, we have Stephen Donziger, one of the United States political prisoners. In fact, he's effectively chevrons political prisoner, Chevron Corporation. Stephen Donziger was one of the attorneys who won a landmark case against Chevron for their devastating pollution in Ecuador. It was an $18 billion settlement. And as payback, and in part of their efforts to avoid paying the money, Chevron has hounded Donziger for years. They have used international tribunals and the U.S. federal court system to prosecute him and to confine him. He joins us from his apartment, where he is under house arrest wearing an ankle bracelet, and does his interview after about almost 2 years of house arrest. Extinction Rebellion Radio with Stephen Donziger, Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. on WBAI. Well, we're moving
on. Hey, this is Baby K.
And this is DJ Kyle McNeil.
Of The Sweet Spot. And we are so excited to announce our brand new time slot, Tuesday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight.
Same great soulful sounds, old and new.
Brand new day, Tuesdays at 10 p.m.
Only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York's Pacifica Radio. Sweet Tuesday.
You're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.